this hour's top stories, hundreds of Palestinians are injured as Israeli forces storm Al-Aqsa Mosque amid growing tensions in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. UN Secretary General Guterres calls on Israel, that is, to cease demolitions and evictions in occupied Palestinian territories. A bomb attack on a bus in southern Afghanistan leaves 11 people dead 2 days after a blast targeting a school in Kabul killed dozens of civilians. Welcome. Violent confrontations erupt in Al-Aqsa Mosque after Israeli forces stormed its courtyard amid escalating tensions in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Take a look. The Palestinian Red Crescent says hundreds of people have suffered injuries after Israeli forces fired stun grenades to disperse Palestinian worshippers. The violence follows another night of clashes between the Israelis and Palestinians protesting Israel's planned evictions in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. 14 Palestinians were injured and 20 others arrested during the night clashes. Meanwhile, Palestinians held demonstrations in Ramallah and Gaza to denounce Israel's efforts to forcefully evict Palestinians from their homes in Al-Quds. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected international calls to stop the forced evictions. To discuss this a little bit further, I'm going to bring in Dr. Sabir Abu Maryam. He's the Secretary General for Palestine Foundation of Pakistan, who comes to you via Skype out of Karachi. Thank you for joining us, sir. Tell me what you think about the recent developments in that part of the world, sir.
Welcome, dear brother. First of all, I would like to strongly condemn these atrocities held in the occupied Palestine, especially in the Quds. What is the question you have asked? The reason why these kinds of activity is going to be held? It is very clear. When some Muslim regime, some Arab regime, went to the sit with the Zionist fake regime, so it has happened because Muslim countries who had acknowledged the illegal and illegitimate state of Israel, they should feel the burden of this situation, because they browed their relation with the Zionist scheme, and they have opportunity for the financial favor instead of responding to the call of Islam. There is no doubt that Israeli terrorism and atrocities are continue under the patronization of Washington, and Washington is the greater ally of these Muslim world. U.S. is the biggest supporter of the terrorism, which has been promoting terrorism against the unarmed civilians and countries all over the world, especially in Palestine. All of the crimes and brutalities doing by the Zionist entity under the patronization of the United States government. So we feel in the Pakistan that U.S. and the Western powers, they all are the similar responsible as stand with Israel and supporting the brutality against the oppressed people of Palestine. At this time, I would like to say that recently the attacks in Afghanistan, which resulted dozens of students killed, also related with the Zionist scheme. As you know that after the Palestine and Kashmir, now the Zionist regime is trying to establish their agenda in the Afghanistan, and also they want to destabilize the Pakistan. So now the current situation in occupied Palestine is very hard and very tough, and we from Pakistan, we stand with our oppressed people of Palestine. We stand for the Al-Quds, we stand for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But this time is to realize for the Muslim and Arab rulers, those are sitting with the Zionist fake regime Israel with the name of normalization.
Okay, many thanks to Dr. Sabir Abu Maryam, Secretary General of Palestine Foundation in Pakistan, out of Karachi. You have a good day, sir. The United Nations Children's Fund says 29 Palestinian kids, including a one-year-old, have been injured in the attacks in East Jerusalem. On what's in a statement, UNICEF said some children were taken to hospital for treatment with injuries in the head and the spine. The UN Children's Agency added that it has received reports of Israeli forces hindering the work of medical staff. It called on Tel Aviv to allow the injured to be treated without restrictions. The statement said 8 Palestinian children were also arrested. The agency urged Israeli authorities to refrain from using violence against children and release all the kids detained. Activist and commentator Ryan Dawson says the Israeli regime routinely murders children in the occupied West Bank and elsewhere, and these atrocities receive little media coverage.
They murder children. They do it in Gaza. They do it in the West Bank. They recently bombed Latakia in Syria and killed a man and injured a child. They routinely detain Palestinian children in their prisons. It is something else for the UN to have to beg for a state to not commit violent acts to children. And by children, we mean toddlers too, babies. There's no line, and there's no media coverage of this in the United States, which is the principal giver of aid to the Israeli state. They wouldn't be able to exist without it. They rely on billions in foreign aid, and yet the public is unaware of all of the torture and murder that the Israeli state routinely does to children. The house evictions are based on what? Because they decided that all of Jerusalem belongs to them, and they're just going to kick people out of private property, make some flimsy excuse like God gave it to me, and they're stealing apartments. If they can't outright take them, they bulldoze them down, like in the West Bank. And when's it going to stop?
The UN and the U.S. have expressed concern over violent clashes in Jerusalem and those sparked by Israel's attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque and its planned eviction of Palestinian families. The UN spokesman quoted the Secretary General as saying that Israel must exercise maximum restraint and respect the right to freedom of peaceful assembly. Antonio Guterres also urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions. The U.S. National Security Advisor also held talks with a top official and urged Tel Aviv to pursue appropriate measures to ensure that is calm. Jake Sullivan said the U.S. is concerned about the potential evictions of Palestinian families, but he failed to denounce the move. Israel's plan for raising homes in Al-Quds neighborhood, to make way for settler units has increased tensions. Oppositions belonging to Palestinian resistance movement Hamas have come under Israeli artillery fire in the Gaza Strip. Our Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon joined us earlier with more on that attack.
Israeli artillery attacked a Hamas security post in the southern Gaza Strip town of Rafah, destroying the security post completely, although no casualties were reported. And just about 15-20 minutes after that, the Israeli artillery also attacked a Hamas security post in northern Gaza. We're still waiting for the details of that recent attack on the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. The Israeli attacks have been taking place on the Gaza Strip for the second day in a row, as Palestinians in Gaza have been protesting near the security fence in the east of the enclave. And also Palestinian resistance groups have fired at least 2 projectiles towards the Israeli regime to protest against the ongoing attacks on the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds, and the attacks on the brethren in the occupied city, and also the attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem.
Iran has condemned any attack on its diplomatic premises after unknown individuals attacked the Iranian consulate in the Iraqi city of Karbala. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said Iraqi security forces thwarted the attack. Khatibzadeh said Iran has contacted Iraqi authorities and also issued a note of protest to the Iraqi embassy in Tehran. He said Tehran expects the Iraqi government to protect the Islamic Republic's diplomatic premises and fulfill its obligations under the 1961 Vienna Convention in the best way possible. On Sunday, a group of insurgents set fire to the outer wall of Iran's consulate in Karbala. India's daily coronavirus cases and fatalities have slightly retreated after hitting record peaks over the past several days. The health ministry reported more than 366,000 infections and over 3,700 deaths in the past 24 hours. No fatalities have taken the overall tally to over 246,000. Infection cases now stand at over 22.6 million. The world's second most populous nation is spiraling deeper into the COVID-19 crisis since last month after a new highly infectious variant detected there. A second wave has forced most Indian states to impose complete shutdowns. The country currently has over 3.6 million active cases, with hospitals in major cities facing shortages of equipment and oxygen. The federal government is reluctant to declare a national lockdown over fear of its impact on the economy. The raging coronavirus pandemic in India has raised concerns about the health of Kashmiri political prisoners in Indian-run jails. Families of the prisoners say they are not getting the medical attention they need. Family members want the immediate release of their loved ones. Our correspondent in Indian administered Kashmir, Shahanabad, has the details.
The Indian-administered Kashmir witnessed the death of one of its prominent pro-freedom leaders in an Indian-run jail this week. Ashraf Zehra's death has raised concerns about the scores of political prisoners languishing in Indian prisons as the country combats a fresh surge in coronavirus cases and deaths. That's amid testimonies by members of the 78-year-old's family, who said he died due to lack of health care and improper prison conditions after he tested positive for coronavirus. Now families of other political prisoners fear they could also face Sehrai's fate. The father of the 19-year-old Seher Shabir has spent 33 years of his life in different Indian detention centers. Shabir Shah is in prison for actively supporting Kashmir's right to self-determination.
My father's health conditions are not really good, and I and my family fare a lot in this case because he is having already many serious health ailments, and his life is in danger because we can't take the risk right now as COVID is increasing day by day and he has been denied treatment. Also, apart from all this, we have no contact with him.
Sahar's father is among scores of Kashmiris who are imprisoned for supporting the region's independence from Indian rule. They are incarcerated under India's Public Safety Act, a preventive detention act that authorizes detention of any person for up to 3 months without a trial, and the detention period is extendable. Rights groups say the law has often been exploited to keep pro-independence supporters behind the bars. Human rights activist Ehsan Untu was also jailed recently. He says the central government has made it difficult to bail prisoners out.
The treatment of Kashmiri political prisoners in India is unfair. We are often kept with the criminals and are denied basic health care and medical attention. The entire setup is against Kashmiri prisoners. Even courts do not hold fair hearings. The international community must take action. Otherwise, no Kashmiri will walk alive from Indian jails.
Due to the raging pandemic last year, India's top court handed the decision to release prisoners on interim bail to the powerful state committees. Around 45,000 prisoners were released under the guidelines. However, not many of them were from among Kashmiri political prisoners. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has vowed that his country will firmly defend national interests at a time of soaring tensions between Moscow and the West. He made the remarks in an address to a ceremony marking the 76th anniversary of the victory in World War II. Press TV's Marina Kurtanova reports.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Moscow consistently defends international law and at the same time will firmly defend its national interests to ensure the safety of its people. He made the remarks during a speech to thousands of soldiers and veterans on Red Square during the annual parade, which marked the 76th anniversary of victory in the World War II.
Our people know too well how this can end. Russia is consistently defending international law while continuing to protect our national interests and the security of our people. Our guarantees are the glorious Russian armed forces, descendants of the victorious troops, and of course our joint efforts for the sake of our country's development and the well-being of Russian families.
Vladimir Putin voiced concern over what he described as a creeping return of ideologies of the time when slogans of racial and national superiority, of anti-Semitism and Russophobia became even more cynical.
Unfortunately, attempts are made to deploy a large part of Nazi ideology and the ideas of those who were obsessed with the delusional theory of their own supremacy. This ideology is not only supported by radicals and international terrorist groups of all kinds.
The parade was participated by more than 12,000 troops, 191 units of military ground equipment, and 76 planes and helicopters. Military parades and festive events commemorating the Soviet victory took place in almost all Russian cities.
I consider the Victory Day as the greatest holiday of Russia. Many Russians lost their life to liberate Europe. Victory is victory, and it was very, very difficult. This is a great day for the Soviet people. Our republics of the Soviet Union won a great victory. Some powers are seeking to distort history. They say that the victory was won by the Americans, French, or Britons. It's a lie.
This year's parade comes at a time when Moscow's relations with the West are severely strained over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine and the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned last week that relations between the Kremlin and Washington could plunge to the Cold War level if Washington continued to reject dialogue with Moscow.
The Soviet Union lost about 27 million people, 40% of all human losses in the World War II. A significant part fell on the civilian population of the country. According to the Soviet Extraordinary State Commission for the Establishment and Investigation of the Atrocities of the German Fascist Invaders, about 2,000 cities and towns, over 70,000 villages in the USSR were completely or partially destroyed by the occupiers. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Well, that's it for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. In one of the oldest streets of Tehran. Today I've invited my grandma for iftar. One of the sweets that we Iranians serve for iftar in the holy month of Ramadan is zulbia. So today I've come to an old confectionery which sells zulbia for over 40 years. My grandma, who has a sweet tooth, loves the zulbia which is baked in this confectionery. Oh, what a long queue! I can't stand in long lines, so I'd better go to the house of Bibi Shahrzad for buying zulbia. The zulbia which is baked in this confectionery is also very crispy and delicious. Zulbia is a crunchy sweet which doesn't need to be kept in refrigerator. This sweet is usually baked and distributed in the month of Ramadan. You can always find it at cloths spread for iftar during this month in Iran. The exact date of the invention of this treat is not clear. One of the earliest mentions of this delicacy dates back to 1450 AD in India. In the book Tarikh-e Nasiri, we read that at the period of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar rule, this sweet was brought to the king as a souvenir. At the time of Muzaffaruddin Shah rule, this sweet was baked in Iran. In the past, traveling salesmen used to sell zulbia in big trays through the streets and alleys. Today, during the month of Ramadan, almost all confectionaries sell zulbia along other sweets. I am now in the yard of the house of Bibi Shahrzad. She is a veteran confectioner who sells zulbia every year during Ramadan. Bibi Shahrzad uses a wood-burning stove for making zulbia. Firstly, she prepares the special syrup of zulbia. So, she pours water into the pot. Then, she adds the sugar and mixes the water with sugar with a big ladle. Now, she adds a handful of crushed cardamom seeds to the mixture and stirs again until the syrup becomes thick and ready. She puts the syrup aside and puts some starch in a container. Then she adds some yogurt to the starch and mixes them together. Now she adds some flour, oil, saffron, and rose water to the mixture, stirs them, and put the container's lid back. Oh well, she puts a big pan full of oil on the fire. Oh, too much oil. In this stage, Bibi Shahrzad ladles some of the prepared batter in a piping bag and holds the piping bag over the hot oil and moves the piping bag in a circular motion, forming a circle twisty shape. Now, after frying, Bibi Shahrzad skims the zulbia and drizzles them with cooled syrup. She finally takes the sweets out of the syrup. Now, zulbia is ready to be served in iftar cloths. About a kilogram of zulbia from Bibi Shahrzad. My grandma will surely get excited by seeing the tantalizing zulbia.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. On Saturday, multiple explosions took place in the Afghan capital of Kabul. The death toll has risen to 68. Most of the casualties have been high school girls as the explosions took place outside of the school when the girls were on their way home. At least 160 others were also wounded. Now, the Afghan government has blamed the Taliban. However, the Taliban has denied involvement. What is going on in Afghanistan as we have seen a rise in attacks since Washington has announced its pull-off from the country by September the 11th. Let's cross over to Kabul, joined by Amin Alami. Amin, thanks so much for being with us. Please fill us in on the latest situation.
Well, Marzia, Kabul residents witnessed another tragic day as back-to-back explosions hit a high school in western part of the capital, Kabul. According to official statistics, at least 68 civilians, most of them schoolgirls, were killed and over 150 others sustained injuries. Most of the injured victims of this incident were shifted to nearby hospitals as well as to Kabul's emergency hospital for war victims. I went to the blast scene as well as I visited some of the victims of this incident in Kabul's emergency hospital. Marzia was one of those students who has sustained injuries. She said that when we were leaving the school to home, a huge car bomb blast happened in front of the entrance gate of the school, and then I cannot remember what happened. Another man who was a shopkeeper also said that when I heard a very loud explosion, I rushed to the blast scene as I was looking for my own daughter there. He also said that after a few moments, there was another blast, and it was a roadside bomb blast, and after a few minutes, there was the third blast. That is why the casualties are high. According to witnesses and local residents in Kalainau area in western part of the Afghan capital, Kabul, the blasts were too huge, and most of the families who live close to this high school have lost one or two of their family members. This comes as the Afghan government, specifically the Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani, strongly condemned the incident and blamed the Taliban militant group for being behind such attack. But the Taliban also released a statement and condemned the attack and said, "We are not involved in launching attacks on civilian targets." But in the meantime, let's not forget that the Afghan capital, Kabul, as well as many other big cities of this country witnessed similar attacks in the past as well. Most of those attacks were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. For instance, I can point out at least three deadly terrorist attacks on educational centers in western part of the Afghan capital, Kabul, that claimed the lives of at least 150 school students and university students that were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. However, the rise of insecurity and bloodshed in Afghanistan comes as there are also efforts to bring peace and stability to this country via relying on negotiations.
All right, thanks so much.
Is one of the players that stress on following the negotiations. Besides the Afghan government, the people of Afghanistan and many other rights bodies as well as independent international bodies also call on the Taliban as well as on what they name it, the supporter of Taliban to say yes to the demand of the Afghan people.
Okay, thanks so much. I think you have a delay. I'm not sure if you can hear me or not, but that we're going to end that with Amin Alami, correspondent in Kabul, because I definitely want to get to our main guests for this program. I'd like to welcome our guest, Madia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink out of Washington, D.C., and Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Madia, let me start with you. I mean, we look at the situation in Afghanistan and this unbelievable violence that is taking place, and we look at the involvement in the United States, 20 years in that country. What has been accomplished? Because it definitely seems that security is one of those things that has not been really brought to Afghanistan. So what has the U.S. been doing in that country all these years?
Well, it's quite horrific that after these 20 years of U.S. occupation and billions and billions, if not trillions, of dollars being spent, including $88 billion just training the Afghan security forces, that the U.S. and the allies have not been able to build a stable democratic government in Afghanistan. And so the violence is a testament to the fact that the United States has been part of that violence rather than being any solution that would bring peace and security to the Afghan people.
Elijah, we have seen an increase in attacks in Afghanistan recently. Why do you think that this is happening at this point in time? On the one hand, if we look at the attacks yesterday, the government pointed a finger at the Taliban. The Taliban denied involvement and said they do not attack civilians. And as our correspondent said, it has similar earmarks to what Daesh and others have been doing. But overall, what's your perspective about this increase?
Yes, I do really agree with your correspondent. This has had the fingerprint of ISIS rather than the Taliban. There is also a significant indication of the failure of the local security forces. I mean, the car has been there for 24 hours, and this area has been targeted before. And ISIS doesn't really target specific objective to send a message, but it's a random against civilians. This is not the way that Taliban has been doing, particularly after the negotiations that has been held in Qatar and in other places, and the will of the U.S. to withdraw, although the U.S. did not respect its deal that was concluded by Donald Trump of the withdrawal of the 1st of May. And that increases the tension in the country and increases the instability. And now Biden is saying he's going to withdraw by the 11th of September. And that puts also Taliban off its commitment, because it is not guaranteed that Taliban is not going to stop attacking the U.S., particularly when the U.S. are continuing to bomb areas under the Taliban control. Therefore, it is obvious that the security in the country is going to be hectic as long as the Americans are there and as long as there is no national reconciliation among all parties.
Madia, why do we not see international condemnation and outrage at this increased number of attacks and fatalities taking place in Afghanistan? I mean, if we look at the situation yesterday, outside of a girls' high school. If it had taken place anywhere else, we would be seeing so much people condemning what has taken place, memorials set up to remember the victims. Why isn't that the case when it comes to Afghanistan?
I think a lot of the world has turned a blind eye and washed their hands of what's going on in Afghanistan. The violence has been going on for more than 20 years. And here in the United States, there's a sense of let's just get out of there and get over this. So I think such a horrific attack that, as you say, would have made headline news all over the world is really disregarded and seen as just a part of the landscape of a place like Afghanistan. And it's just astounding that there's not more of an international outcry.
I mean, you talked about the United States. Let's talk about inside the United States, because in general, when something like this happens, exactly like you said, in a country like Afghanistan that has been under violence so long, Medea, people basically sometimes look at, well, that's just how they are over there. And not connecting the role of the U.S. government and the troops, the American troops that are there, and the lack of stability in this country. Your take, Medea.
Yes, I think the narrative is those people just fight each other. And one has to question the role of the U.S. and also where do all these weapons come from? And so much of the weapons on all sides have come from the United States that has just poured weapons into Afghanistan and all of the Middle East. And so many of the U.S. weapons companies have become enriched by this violence that's ongoing in Afghanistan and the larger region. And if the United States, after 20 years, was not able to bring any kind of stability to Afghanistan, then it has to be questioned, what was it doing? Why is the government in Afghanistan so corrupt? Was the U.S. part of this corruption? Well, of course, pouring all this money in, and the U.S. military can't even acknowledge where many, many billions of dollars goes. And then blames the Afghans for being corrupt and blames the Afghan for being violent.
Elijah, in any situation, I mean, if we look at these attacks, usually we ask the question, who benefits from these attacks? And you said that it was not the trademark of the Taliban, these attacks that took place yesterday, but more likely Daesh. If we look at then Daesh, and who has supported Daesh, and who has armed Daesh, does it not lead back the trail to many Western capitals?
This is a very good question. We've seen since the war in Afghanistan, 2001, we saw the growing of the Mujahideen that goes back to the U.S. finance during the Soviet era and the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And this is exactly what Hillary Clinton said. The people we are fighting today are the same people we have funded. This is really from the mouth of the foreign minister, the U.S. foreign minister. And as your guest said, I really agree. We see corruption wherever the U.S. are going. We saw that in Iraq. It's exactly the same, hundreds of billions of dollars. We see the increase of Mujahideen. We see the increase of ISIS in Syria. The Americans watch them growing in Iraq and crossing from Iraq to Syria and said nothing, and then supporting these terrorist groups also in Syria, training them and financing them. So it's exactly, history is repeating itself. ISIS is in Afghanistan as it is in the rest of different parts of Africa and the Middle East, but is also, we see how strongly the U.S. invested in destabilizing the area, and it is time for them to leave, but leave not only Afghanistan, but leave Iraq and leave Syria.
But in your perspective, does the U.S. profit from a lack of stability? We see, for example, well, we're talking about Afghanistan right now, so I'll leave it right there with Afghanistan. Does the U.S. benefit from a lack of stability in these countries?
Well, certainly there's a sector of the economy in the U.S. that benefits all of these defense contractors or military contractors that have made so many billions of dollars in the last 20 years want to see these wars continue. But I certainly don't think it's something that benefits the American people, because we have been paying for these wars instead of the money going into healthcare and education and things that benefit people in this country. They've been going to support the violence and the chaos that the U.S. military is part of in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
Elijah, your prognosis in general with the situation that has happened, of course, the U.S. was supposed to leave in May, and now it says in August, and as you said, technically, then there's no agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban now. Do you see these talks continuing at this point, or your prognosis, especially for the next few months?
I think talks to reach a conclusion in Qatar, and when the Americans sat with the Taliban and concluded the deal, there is no more talk to be made, at the exception of the U.S. leaving the country. However, we see alarming indication from the U.S. saying we will not completely leave, and we will keep a kind of counterterrorism units to keep watching what's happening in the country.
Yes.
I mean, after 100,000 troops, they didn't manage to do so. Taliban today control 30% of the districts. The other 30% are also contested. Therefore, after 20 years with 100,000 troops, what the hell the Americans are still doing in the country? There is no justification. The deal has been made, and they should have respected it, and they should have left on May. And now Biden is begging for the Taliban not to attack, because during the attack, the forces are more vulnerable. And Taliban said, we're not going to respect it because you did not respect the deal. So that's it.
Well, Elijah, what do you think that means, this anti-terror group that Washington says has to remain? What do you get from that?
I get that they will keep some kind of control on the local government. They would like to keep the dictate on the government in Kabul to make sure that their interests are still looked after in the country. Therefore, I don't think the Americans will permanently leave and definitely let the Taliban and the central government and all the other groups sit around the table and sort out their own problems. That's also not something easy to achieve. A domestic national reconciliation is not going to be so easy, but the Americans would like to keep a foothold in the country, and that is under a different title, and that they call it counterterrorism. If they consider the Taliban are no longer a threat, then there is no reason to keep the counterterrorism units in the country.
Your take on that, Madia, because we've seen, for example, we saw troops leaving Iraq, but then not really leaving Iraq. And now, as our other guest has said, about the anti-terror troops that Secretary of State said that would be left there in Afghanistan. Your assessment of all this, when the United States sees the situation, for example, Afghanistan is very important to it strategically, do you think that really that Washington is going to totally leave Afghanistan?
Well, it will certainly maintain the ability to come back in with airstrikes, with drone strikes. There will be CIA operatives. There will be people still training, the untrainable Afghan military after 20 years of training. So they won't be totally gone. But I do think it is a positive thing. I agree that the troops should have left by May 1st, and it would have made the withdrawal easier. But I do think it is a positive thing that the U.S. troops will leave, and hopefully most of the contractors as well. But let's not kid ourselves. The U.S. is not going to totally wipe its hands from Afghanistan. It wants to maintain some ability to go back in.
Well, Madia, based on what you're saying, then do you see continued instability? Because if we're talking about drone strikes or being able to attack at any time, so it means, for example, if Kabul, if the government or whichever government is in power by that time and doesn't walk the walk that the United States defines, then wouldn't it be even easier for them to cause even more instability, and especially with CIA operatives on the ground?
Well, we've seen from this attack, if indeed it was ISIS, that there is that there are different kinds of groups. And let's remember, there are all kinds of warlords in Afghanistan that will be jockeying for power. It's not just the Afghan government and the Taliban. So there will be, unfortunately, a lot of violence for years to come because there are so many different groups vying for power and there are so many weapons. And this is become the occupation of so many of the Afghan men that I don't think we're going to see an end to the violence in the short term.
Elijah, your prognosis for Afghanistan beyond August?
I really agree. I don't think there is going to be stability as long as there is no national reconciliation in the country. And that is really important to allow the Afghani to sort out their own problems, whatever time they need, how long they need, it doesn't matter. Even, yes, I agree there are many warlords. The country has been under a war for 20 years. That's not easy. There's a lot to be done, reconstructing also the souls and the national reconciliation. That is not going to be easy. But it will take time, but it's better to start with without the Americans, without the presence of any foreign troop. Let the people of the Middle East and the West Asia sort out their own problems.
And, Madia, 1 minute I have. I mean, this war was started in 2000 war, allegedly the war on terror by George W. Bush. In your perspective, what has been accomplished in these 20 years by the United States in Afghanistan?
Countless numbers of Afghans killed, millions displaced, millions wounded, thousands of U.S. soldiers, over $1 trillion U.S. dollars sunk into all of this chaos and bloodshed. That's what's been, quote, accomplished in these 20 years, and it's horrific. And unfortunately, on top of all that, I don't think in the U.S. the lessons have been learned, that we shouldn't go in and invade and occupy other countries.
And with that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Madia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink out of Washington, D.C., and Elijah McNeil, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Allah, 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 Allah.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند این ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
I invite you to listen to a short part of Chapter 9 of the book Sirr al-Salat, The Secret of Prayer by Imam Khomeini, General Secrets and Disciplines of the Adhan and Iqama. Its general discipline is to be aware of the greatness of the position, its significance and the majesty of the presence and the present. And it is servility, helplessness, poverty, incapability, and shortcoming of the possible existence in crying, in carrying out orders, and deserving to attend the meeting, unless the kindness and mercy of Allah the Most High extend the helping hand to make up for the shortcomings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini, in one of his speeches, he talks about the month of Ramadan. And when he's talking about the month of Ramadan, he says that you have been invited to the God's feast. a person who becomes the guest of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who has been hosted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he has to prepare himself in the first 20 days, in the first two decades. So basically he has to prepare himself in the first two decades. Once he is prepared, he can benefit the most from the Laylatul Qadr, and he can benefit from a spiritual meal which is Holy Quran. When you are the guest of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you do not need to dress well, you do not need to put on a perfume, you do not need to have good clothes. All you need to do is to fast during the day and to pray during the night.
كم أهواك يا شهر الصيام أنا لن أنساك فأنت في قلبي دائما تمضي الأيام ودعائي كل عام ربي تقبلنا يا ربي بلغنا بلغنا رمضان
All you need to do is to hold on to the Quran, read the Quran, try to understand the Quran. And once you do that, you will reach to a level where you can benefit the most from the nights of the Qadr, the night that is better than thousands of months, better than thousands of months, a night which is better, not even equal. Allah did not say that this Laylatul Qadr is equal to the thousand months. He said, Khayrum, it is better than. Now, what does this better than mean? It means at least it is thousand months in which a person prays to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But it is better than even thousand months. So we all need to be prepared for the month of Ramadan, especially for the nights of the Qadr, so that Allah forgive us in this month and He takes us out, He takes us out of the darkness and takes us towards His light, inshallah. May Allah give us tawfiq to benefit the most from the month of Ramadan and to be amongst the most pious people when Ramadan finishes, inshallah. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
As COVID-19 cases continue to surge in Indian-administered Kashmir, Mohammad Afaq Saeed has been swamped with distress calls from people looking for oxygen. Afaq leads the oxygen campaign of a Srinagar-based NGO. His small team of dedicated volunteers is working round the clock to help COVID patients gasping for breath.
We have one of the biggest oxygen programs in this region, in Kashmir. We have a lot of oxygen cylinders, a lot of oxygen concentrators, then non-invasive ventilation machines, and other supportive equipment. So this way, a lot of pressure from hospitals has been released.
With the Himalayan region's healthcare system reeling under tremendous pressure, Good Samaritans and social organizations have come forward to extend helping hand to people in need. Athrod Kashmir, a prominent philanthropic organization based out of Kashmir's summer capital, has converted the region's Hajj House into a spacious 100-bed COVID center. The facility aims to cater to the rising number of COVID patients requiring hospitalization.
We have established this facility in collaboration with state administration. The facility has 28 beds with high flow oxygen capacity and 72 beds with oxygen supply. We will add 100 more beds here with oxygen support system very soon.
As hospitals are scrambling to shore up oxygen supplies, the authorities have decided to install over 30 new oxygen generating plants in the region. Also, the government is constructing a 500-bedded COVID hospital in central Kashmir's Budgam district.
The work on this project is to be completed within 35 to 40 days. The hospital will have 125 beds as intensive care unit, and rest of the beds will have oxygen supply system.
Meanwhile, COVID cases continue to pile up in Kashmir, with almost 5,000 cases and 50-plus deaths being reported on a daily basis. Authorities have already extended the lockdown in the region.
As second wave of COVID-19 pandemic continues to take toll on healthcare system here, experts believe the worst is still ahead. Amid the unprecedented surge of the infections, Good Samaritans are lending a helping hand to the needy, even as fear and anxiety loom large. Sayyidli Safid, Indian Administered Kashmir.
According to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, nearly 200 civilians were killed and some 400 others were injured following the Taliban's increasing attacks since the beginning of the fasting month of Ramadan.
As their statement says, most of the victims were targeted either by roadside bomb blasts, car bomb attacks, or targeted assaults. This comes as intense fighting is underway between the Afghan National Army and Taliban militants across some key provinces in southern and northern parts of the country.
Meanwhile, top military officials in Kabul say that counter-attack operations conducted by Afghan government forces have claimed the lives of nearly 1,000 Taliban militants over the same period.
The resolute and quick response of our brave armed forces defeated Taliban in the battles in key districts, mainly in Kandahar and neighboring Helmand province in southern parts of Afghanistan. This is why they use roadside bombs and car bomb attacks as new tactics to resist. Of course, they will fail.
While the Afghan government and the Taliban are struggling to have the upper hand on the battlefields, local Afghans continue to view the controversial Afghan peace talks as the only possible way for bringing calm and security to their war-ravaged country after years of instability.
Decades-long war in our countries prove that there would be no victory for anybody through militarism. Both sides should forget about war and continue to negotiate as a logical way for ending the misery in our nation.
Recently, U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan Zalmay Khalilzad said the Taliban have shown a green light to the Istanbul summit on the Afghanistan peace process. The summit was scheduled for April 24th, but it was postponed after the Taliban refused to attend it amid postponement of the withdrawal of the U.S. troops from Afghanistan. In a peace deal between Washington and the Taliban signed in the Qatari capital, May the 1st was designated as the deadline for the U.S. troops pullout. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine held a press conference warning that Israeli regime will face retaliatory measures over its ongoing attacks in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip marked Saturday as a day of popular rage along the border fence, where the resistance announced a return of military clashes with the Israeli army and firing incendiary balloons toward Israel in response to the crimes committed in Jerusalem al-Quds.
What is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds is systematic apartheid policy that aims to demolish the Palestinian cause. The recent eviction of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah is totally refused by Palestinians. So the resistance in Gaza announces the return of clashes on the borders and calls for a new uprising if these violations continue.
In a recent speech, resistance leaders warned that Israel should bear the responsibility over the recent attacks against Palestinian residents in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds, saying the resistance is ready to defend Jerusalem with all means.
We hold the Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of the crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian resistance won't sit idle against the killing and eviction of Palestinians. Jerusalem is our red line. All Palestinian groups are united in responding to these crimes, and the response will be heavy.
Palestinians called on the international community and all Muslim nations to support Palestinians and do actions to stop the Israeli violations of Palestinians and the ongoing attacks of the holy place.